This is KZSU, Stanford. I'm Alexandra Moore, the producer of Entitled Opinions. Today, we have a special episode, rebroadcasting an interview Robert sat for with Masoud Ghassiyev on his YouTube show, Philosophy Every Day. The episode aired in early March, and many topics Masoud chose were inspired by Robert's book, The Dominion of the Dead. Together, they explore the roles of death, mortality, and technology in shaping our shared human world. Robert even offers some insights into his forthcoming book, The Spirit of Gravity, Chronicles of a Mortal Earth. So take a deep breath and find a comfy spot, because we're blasting off into the techno-existential realm of philosophy every day.
Why has death become such an uncomfortable topic in modern societies? Because it seems to me that death is the most universal human experience, yet we seem deeply uncomfortable talking about it.
Yes, I agree with you. The problem with death, just from a metaphysical point of view, is that on the one hand, as you say, it's a common experience. On the other hand, it's not something that anyone experiences until the moment that it occurs. And therefore, it's this vast, open horizon of the unknown and of a kind of impenetrability, inscrutability. And I think it's the inscrutability of the eventual moment of death, understood as a biological death, that makes the topic of death such an anxious element of disorientation among us. I think previous societies to the modern society did a much better job of confronting the fact of death and in the face of this common future possibility that awaits us all. Most pre-modern societies founded their institutions and religions and traditions upon this basis of our mortality. Human beings have been understood in most cultures as the mortals as opposed to the immortals. And their mortality means more than just the fact that we are going to perish biologically. That's a distinction Martin Heidegger will use, the difference between perishing and dying, where perishing is something that takes place at the end. It's a termination of life at the end of one's biological existence, whereas dying is a human experience all along the way, given that we have a foreknowledge of the final end in death. Even if we don't know what it consists in, we do have a foreknowledge that it's about to occur. And therefore, we have societies that, in the face of this, eventual perishing, have created forms of mortality that are also forms of community and of binding people together according to customs and mores and traditions and beliefs. And if you wanted to define human civilization in one pregnant formulation, you could call it the formal power to transform mortality into history, or to transform death into community. So in this sense, I don't agree with Unamuno. I don't know who reads Unamuno anymore, or if your listeners are going to be bummed out by my sense that he has a kind of misguided understanding when he posits that we all desire our personal immortality, and that this irrational desire for a personal immortality is in conflict with our reason, which understands that personal immortality is denied to everyone, and that we should live within the conflict and so forth. What I think that kind of thinking leaves out of consideration is the communal nature by which death becomes a kind of ground for the formation of polities and group identity, even ethnic identities and so forth. So rather than commit myself to the thesis that each one of us as individuals has an irrational desire for immortality, I would say that human groups come together around the shared mortality that define us and which ultimately give meaning to the unfolding of a human life.
One of the common analogies that I think of is we can think of all of us, humanity, commonly in the Titanic. Yeah, we're all going to sink at some point. Does what you say also relate to the idea that we come up with institutions, culture, beliefs, religions to make sense of that reality, and whether that is rational or irrational? Or is this the fundamental thing that makes us create those institutions, morality, belief, and so on?
Well, let's think about it, Masoud. If you think that we're all on the Titanic, then you have an idea that we are on this linear trajectory and that it all ends in a shipwreck. And what that idea seems to leave out of the account is possibilities of continuation, you know, beyond the perishing of particular individuals in a particular society in a particular historical period. And here I think there's an immense difference between pre-modern societies that often were embedded within a cyclical view of time, where the Titanic doesn't just sink and it's all over, but that while you're on the Titanic, you are passing on and reproducing the customs, mores, and faiths of your own society. And the whole purpose of a life, or to say that the most meaningful aspect of a human existence, was to accomplish this purpose of replication and transmission, the transmission of legacy. Now, what that means is that there's something beyond the Titanic. And it can be future generations. If we're speaking collectively, it's for the future generations. And so much of human motivation is directed towards a future to which we will not belong, and yet to which we feel that we have a commitment, or at least we used to feel that we had a commitment. And the things that one wants to leave behind, there's a sense that they would have an afterlife, even if we don't have an afterlife. This is where the theory that I just, Adam Brader, Unamuno, and others, the personal immortality, we have a ways around the problem of personal immortality in that regard. So if there is a kind of secular afterlife among the living and among the future generations, then that gives the unfolding of a human life a certain meaning, where at the end, death is not just an absurd termination of life, but it's the culmination. It's the coming into fruition. You have accomplished the purpose of that transmission. When you get into the modern period and you have a culture like our own, where we understand human existence as being on this kind of progressive trajectory, and history is open-ended, and we don't know how it's going to end, and there's this constant progress, innovation, changes, the newness of things, it creates a sense that we belong only to a small fragment of an infinity that is beyond our reach. And that therefore, the result is that not life, but death becomes meaningless, insofar as life is the only value, or it's the only place where meaning can take place, because death comes up about arbitrarily and without being the fulfillment of anything, but merely the termination of life. And when you think of death only as the termination of life, then it's not life, but death itself, which becomes meaningless. But of course, when death becomes meaningless, so does life become meaningless. And that's where I think you're right to say that we live in an era today where, you know, these questions, precisely because they're so difficult to ponder and come to terms with, that it's much better just simply to ignore them.
Okay, there are so many interesting concepts there. Secular immortality. History is open-ended. History is not has no end. And life losing its meaning if there was no death. Yeah, that makes sense. If I had knowledge of I would live endlessly, I will never die, then the life itself becomes something casual in a very initial sense. I don't have to really care about that. And we can think of all the institutions, culture, science, whatever we have built them around this idea that we will one day die, each of us, and we want to leave out something before we die. It's like we are almost always pregnant with something that we want to bring to the world that would outlive us.
That's right. And there you're pointing to the fact that death is not just at the end, but it's at the beginning. In fact, it precedes the beginning. Because it's where you say that what we're pregnant, and this idea of pregnancy is also a philosophical concept that Socrates, when he speaks to Diotima in the Symposium, Diotima says, we are all pregnant, Socrates, with sometimes we're pregnant with poems, we can be pregnant with virtues or heroic deeds, and we all want to give birth in the presence of beauty, whatever birth that is. And so, this pregnancy, however, is predicated on mortality because you have no natality, namely new beginnings, you know, without mortality. It's the difference between a artificial flower made of plastic and, you know, an organic flower, which by definition, you know, it fades, and its beauty in the presence of which one wants to give birth, the beauty is due to the fact that there's an evanescence and a passing I think maybe the most eloquent phrasing of that is from the American poet Wallace Stevens. So I have a quote here. I figured that we might get on this topic, so I have it here in front of me. It's called Sunday Morning, and it's a young woman sitting in a chair on a Sunday morning in a garden and thinking about these issues. And, you know, there's this idea that the Garden of Eden, which is a garden where we would, the myth, and it's a myth in many different cultures and different versions, but it's always the same place where there's no suffering, there's perpetual spring, flowers, and no death above all. But where there's no death, there's no birth. And we know that Adam and Eve in the Judeo-Christian myth of it, they do not give birth until they get out of the garden and are expelled from it. Anyway, Wallace Stevens, inside the mind of the young woman, asks herself the following question. Is there no change of death in paradise? Does ripe fruit never fall? Or do the boughs hang always heavy in that perfect sky, unchanging, yet so like our perishing earth, with rivers like our own that seek for seas they never find, the same receding shores that never touch with inarticulate pang? Why set the pear upon those river banks, or spice the shores with odors of the plum? Alas, that they should wear our colors there, the silken weaving of our afternoons, and pick the strings of our insipid lutes, and hear the line, death is the mother of beauty, mystical, within whose burning bosom we devise our earthly mothers waiting sleeplessly. So this idea that death is the mother, it means that it comes first. And from death, very expansively understood as a condition of mortality and evanescence and things being born, developing organically, and then coming to a kind of organic end. That is where things begin. It's not where things end. So this is a very radical understanding and counterintuitive in many ways, a counterintuitive understanding of death as an originator rather than a terminator.
That's interesting. Counterintuitive, but maybe like as a human being, we are not always the best sources of information regarding what we believe to be true. There are so many things behind subconsciousness. But that was a very interesting line. This reminded me of something else that I read a long time ago. Master and Margarita. Yeah, they touch upon this idea there for a long time. I think there is a conversation there, I may not remember it correctly, but between Jesus or Satan, where Satan says, what would your light be if there was no darkness? And there is also another line says, do you want to get rid of all the trees in the world just for your fantasy of pure light? That is impossible. So you can't have light without dark. You can't have life without death. You can't have good without evil.
Well, yeah, of course, that's one sort of take on the figure of Jesus. You can look at it differently and say, who is, you know, a more major figure asserting the primacy of death than the crucified, where an immortal God humanizes and mortalizes himself in order to live a life that ends on a cross, and that through that death, we have also, theologians have understood it as a giving of birth. It's a giving of birth of a new religion, of a new hope, of new whatever, a new horizon of things. But again, it's through the death that this vita nuova, this new life, is born. I've always been struck by the fact that in the Christian scriptures, there's this notion that Jesus on the cross is speared by one of the Roman soldiers, and from the wound in his side flows blood and water. And you say, well, that is weird, isn't it? And yet, when it's depicted in art history, then it seems like a very vulval wound. And this water and blood that's coming from it seems to indicate that Jesus is mothering something. Something is being born from this event. So here is again another inflection of the previous principle that I tried to articulate about the generative power of death.
Yeah, there is also this sense of urgency. Yeah? If you're living your life, if you have this knowledge of death that's going to come after you, I think I've read somewhere, I think that was maybe one of the Steve Jobs' main motivations. He was always like conscious of one day he's going to die, and that's why he was rushing to get everything done. But I'm also interested in what you mentioned earlier, secular immortality. So does that imply that even without belief in religion, you're still looking for that kind of immortality that you might have lost if you are not believing in religion, and you may find it elsewhere?
Yeah, I think the word I used was secular afterlife, which is similar. I mean, it's like it's not immortality as such, but the fact that something continues after, you know, your own life is over. So I think there's a philosopher about 10 years ago who wrote a book that trying to imagine what would happen to the world if it were absolutely certain that an asteroid were going to hit us within a week or let's say, or even within 2 years, 3 years, whatever kind of, but a specific moment in the future and was going to wipe out all life on Earth and everything was going to come to an end. And, you know, he rightly points out that almost every person's endeavors and tasks and projects in life will come to an abrupt halt because it would make no sense to go on doing what one is doing every day of one's life in the absence of a sense that there's something that will continue in the future. And therefore, in our everyday lives, whether we're conscious of it or not, we are behaving on the assumption that there is going to be an afterlife. By an afterlife, you don't have to be a religious afterlife. It's a secular afterlife, that there is going to be a world that outlasts us. The same way the world proceeds our entering into it, and the world, it will continue, you know, after our exit from it. And it's this assumption of a continuity and permanence of the context within which we live. That's how I understand the idea of a secular afterlife. So yes, you don't have to buy into religious dogma to believe in this afterlife. In fact, you don't even need to believe in it at all, because it's so intrinsic to our psychology that we are always behaving on that predicate of there being a world that will outlast us.
Yeah, that kind of would explain why, even with the knowledge that everything decays at the end, everything ends, we are still carrying out as if we are going to live forever. And yeah, this idea of secular afterlife, even if you don't believe in religion, but what's the source of it? Like, how was, is it the case that religion didn't really play that much role before? Because if we, let's take a look at the organized religion and how many thousands of years we have it, and compare it with the whole life cycle of Homo sapiens. Yeah, it predates even before we had organized religions. But is it this fundamental urge to find something everlasting? Going back to this Plato's idea that we want to give birth before we die. Like, yes. What would be the case if, let's say, I don't know if I will die or not. What would my life would look like? What would my actions look like if I have no idea whether I will die or not?
Well, it would be a very different life, and it would not be a human life, because I believe the human is not a biological species. It's not just Homo sapiens. Humanity is a way of being in the world as mortal, and therefore Neanderthals can be fully human if indeed it's confirmed that they had these rituals of burying their dead in ritualistic positions, often in the fetal position with red ochre paint, and the ritualization of burial is a sign of humanity. As I understand it, culturally speaking, because humanity is a cultural way of transforming death into meaning. And so if we were to ever realize the post-human dream, which for me is one of the most miserable kind of Silicon Valley tech bro dream of extending life indefinitely, or as they called it, rendering death optional, then you have to ask yourself, what kind of, I think this is a question you're asking, no, what kind of life would result from a condition where you're not going to die? And what I think it would lead to a kind of ghostly condition where, first off, you cannot allow new people to be born, because if you're going to eliminate death, then there's only so many places at the table, so to speak. And the reason, you know, at a certain point, if you're in a restaurant, you have to vacate the table so that, you know, the next party can come and have a seat at the table. But if death becomes optional and everyone's deciding that, you know, they're going to remain in the world ahead, then, so again, you abolish mortality, you abolish natality at the same time. And then you live in a kind of ghostly, kind of zombie state where you don't have the narrative dynamism of a life which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That narrative dynamism all of a sudden disappears. And, you know, you might as well belong in that kind of ghostly Elysian fields where nothing really is happening. So everyone would like to prolong life in a certain sense, but when we have to think about the implications of it rather than just rely on our childish desires not to die. Because once you start reflecting on these issues, then it becomes quite obvious that death is not a curse, that it's not some penalty we pay because we sinned in the Garden of Eden and that we were expelled unto death. No, death is the very condition, a priori condition of life itself. So if you are committed to life, you have to be committed to death.
Yeah, I think you pointed out a very important distinction there on how you can see the death. So one idea would be the one that you mentioned. Yeah, this tech bro idea of treating death as a problem to be solved, mathematical problem to be solved. And here we see those utopian ideas of, okay, what can we, maybe we can even make it optional, versus treating death as like the something that makes you human. So tension between these two ideas is very apparent from, I think, what you're saying.
I think you're right that Steve Jobs would probably have been with the tech bros. I think ultimately he was hoping to live long enough that he could enter the era when he could choose whether to die or not die. And of course, his death was very meaningful in this sense because so much was at stake. He refused the traditional treatment for the cancer that he had, and he ended up taking a risk that he lost. He lost a gamble. But he did give a speech at my own University of Stanford a year before dying that was a really meaningful sort of reflection, where he comes around what you're saying about the alternative to the tech bro thinking of death as a problem to be solved. Yeah.
Since we are talking about this, let me bring another tech bro. I think Elon Musk must have said this, if I remember correctly. I think he was asked once whether he would choose to live forever or not. He said that is part of life, because something has to die all the time. Ideas have to die so that new ideas can come along. Given in basic sense, institutions, let's say companies everywhere, old ideas has to die for the new ones to come. So in that fundamental sense, you can't really wish for immortality, but also wish for new freshness in everywhere.
Yeah, but that makes him sound like a very wise person. Yet when it comes to these kinds of figures, you have to ask, how much is enough if you are living a human life? And if you can understand the logic whereby ideas have to become obsolete in order to make room for new ideas, then I think it's not that far of a leap of thinking or of imagination to say that the human condition is a condition of finitude, that finitude is a basis of our condition, and that at a certain point, things have to be enough. And when you get into the psychology of there never being enough, you can never have enough money, you can never have enough power, or you can never have, enough fame, then you are not living your life ethically on the ontological foundation of finitude as being conditioned by limits. So you can understand why death has to occur in life, and yet you can also just blindly live a life where you're trying to transcend one limit after another limit after another. And I'll tell you, Masood, this is not just a problem about, living our individual lives. It's also the stark realization of the ecology of the planet that we live on, which is a finite planet. It's become more finite than it has ever been in the past, where you had a sense that there were always the open horizons and that you could go beyond into the unknown. But now it's become so starkly obvious that finitude of the planet is also the condition that everyone has to come to terms with and acknowledge, and to understand the need for an ethical reorientation towards the enough is critical for the survival of that world that we talked about earlier, which has always been a context of permanence. And now I think for the first time in history, we're imagining that this context of permanence itself could collapse. And that would be like, if you look at Greek tragedies, they were performed in these amphitheaters in the midst of nature. Yeah, often the mountains and sea in the background, and then the human drama would take place on the stage. But what was always going to remain was the setting, and the setting was the natural world. No one ever suspected that the natural world could be brought into the drama of history taking place on the stage and actually participate in the downfall of the tragic hero, where now it's the setting itself that collapses along with human civilization. And that collapse, if it's going to happen, it's going to be a direct result of our inability or refusal to acknowledge the fundamental limitations, ecological limitations of the planet itself. So the personal ethic and, you know, the communal ethic and the ecological ethic, they all come together around this fundamental question of finitude and why we have such difficulty reconciling ourselves to limits.
What are you most worried about recent technological developments that would destroy that balance?
Well, I don't even worry about it anymore because it's a kind of not a despair, but this sense that I was just reading today in the New York Times that at kindergarten, there are a lot of kindergartens that are introducing iPads to the kindergarten people. I mean, and so what I'm most pessimistic about is the fact that the computer screen, the cell phone screen, or the television screen has become the reality. And that we live in these miniature worlds of the two-dimensional, and that all fundamental connections to the embodied, you know, full-bodied world of nature and the non-virtual has been severed. These connections have been severed. And what kind of species we're going to become when our habitations are inside a screen rather than inside a world, and a social world to begin with, but also the natural world in the larger sense, that I think might change the very definition of what it means to be human. And maybe it will spell the end of humanity as I defined it earlier, as something, you know, based on mortality and a shared sense of a common destiny and so forth.
Is it because of the misalignment between what our biology demands versus updates that we are making to our culture? We can also think of it in this way, our hardware versus our software. Our hardware is very difficult to change. Our biology, they are the same. Impulses, desires, they are there, but we are changing our reality, culture rapidly without even thinking about, like, how many years smartphones have been around. We don't even know the effects of them, long-term effects, civilizational effects. So
I know the effects. I don't need long-term effects because I've been teaching long enough to live through, you know, the iPhone, I think, came in 2005 or something. And I can see a fundamental difference, not just the iPhone, but also the personal computer, between the students I would teach before they had any connection to their phones or even personal computers. And, you know, what happened when the personal computer started, their thinking, that, you know, the students, you know, very psyche. And with the introduction of the smartphone and then subsequently social media and now artificial intelligence, I can see that you're multiplying huge generation. There's huge generation gaps between students who began college without having grown up on with a cell phone, those and after. These fundamental neotericisms of these new innovations are, you know, what I find most depressing is that they're all militating against what your podcast is trying to promote, namely thinking. Thinking is under assault. It's a persecuted religion, and it is something without which I don't think our society can long survive. And that's what worries me about living inside a two-dimensional world of the computer screen. It does not call for thinking. It does not favor, it is not hospitable to thinking. it's something else is going on. It's not the kind of thinking that I consider, doesn't even have to be philosophical thinking, thinking that is a kind of human thinking, a human intelligence, as opposed to an artificial intelligence or a natural intelligence. Yeah. The fact that the computer screen has become our only world, I think, is probably the most calamitous event in the post-war period. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if we even take a statistics, virtual world is the real world now. If you add the amount of time you spent on the computer while you're doing your work, texting, whatever, if you, it may be the case that the virtual world is the real world for you. Yep, that's really.
I mean, yeah, and I'm not criticizing others. I spend hours also. If I think of how much, you know, I'm do my writing through the screen, the emails, even our conversation is taking place in that medium. But this is what Heidegger would call the most recent chapter in the history of being, where the virtual has ousted the real and the actual. It's very hard to remain a champion of the human. I'd say a humanist in the broader sense of the term, humanism, which I have always strived to be a spokesperson for, a certain kind of expansive notion of humanism.
Can we spend a bit more time there, if you could define what humanism means for someone that hears it for the first time, and what do you think is in danger regarding to that, given the current developments?
Yeah, well, traditionally, the understanding of humanism is of a movement, somewhat ideological, in which the human becomes a center, a certain kind of center, and because man is the measure of all things, is that Protagoras saying, where the human becomes the measure of all things. In the Renaissance, it was exalted in those famous drawings of the human body, where it's a whole cosmos seems to be revolving around the human body. And this idea that you get in the early modern period, that now humanity is now free to become the author of its own destiny, that it no longer depends on providence and other things, but that we have this vita activa, the active life, where we can go about becoming the architects of our own world and our own futures. And that is, that's the traditional understanding of humanism. I tend to understand it a little bit more expansively and perhaps Heideggerianly, where his letter on humanism, Martin Heidegger, distinguishes between a certain kind of traditional humanism and what he tried to promote as a more radical understanding of the human as being an openness to being, the kind of being thrown open to the call of being and to be the witness of phenomena, of appearances, of meaning, everything that comes to us both through our senses and through our perception and through our thinking, that this is where the coming into being of things is dependent on our human presence in the world. And it's this openness to the world that I would consider a new kind of humanism. And that openness thinking is a fundamental part of that equation. So yes, I think bearing witness to especially the natural world and turning this sort of mortality that we were speaking about earlier into the shared foundation of our being together, I consider that part of a more expansive humanism.
Yeah, that's a good definite understanding. And yeah, if we link it to the previous discussion about giving birth to something that would outlive us, yeah, if we can imagine a world post-humanism is more prominent. Yeah, let's think about technology. There is always a new iPhone. There is always a new computer. There is always a new version of AI. Companies are spending billions of dollars to build the next big thing. It's almost like a cycle. There is no stop. We want to almost bring something to the world that outlives humanity. And with the AI discussion around future super intelligent AI becoming conscious, it is almost like a successor to humanity in that sense, like post-humanism. And it's like we want to bring something to the world and we want to make consciousness available even if we perish. So let's say individual actors, individual film directors might perish, but AI might still make the movies for us, might still create books for us. So I believe this might be like connection to that world of post-humanism.
I agree with you. I think that something eerie is taking place with artificial intelligence. And whether we are doing it consciously or not, I think we are programming it to be our successors and to inherit all the legacies of our past thought and cultures and knowledge and practices. And it's this grand encyclopedia that will enable our past to continue to have an afterlife once we are no longer have the power ourselves to keep it alive. No? Perhaps the complexity of our civilizations, the sum of our civilizations, is just too much for us humans to be able to administer, to manage, and to also remember, and also to perform the act of transmission that we talked about earlier. You know, how do you reproduce the past? And so perhaps it's gotten so large, the archives of legacies have become so large, that it's going to take this other power of artificial intelligence to do the work of preservation and continuation. It's hard to say because I don't have a crystal ball in order to see the future, but I do tend to agree with you that there's a strange way in which things are being set up for AI to be our successors.
Yeah, if we think about what makes human life valuable, what makes someone individual valuable, if you think about something, okay, ability to suffer might be there, death might be there, consciousness might be there. So if those things exist in something that's not human, we start having discussions around what is valuable besides human beings. So,
right. There's also the logos. If you think about the human, that's perhaps is what is most easily reproducible artificially. If you understand logos as rationality or as language. Of course, there's a deeper meaning to logos, which is to bind, legein. In Greek, you know, means to bring together, to bind together. And in some ways, you can say AI does that. But this binding is also a social way of coming together in communities, polities, nations, and a commonwealth, even a world commonwealth. This kind of binding, I think we are existing in a historical moment of the dislexification of the lex, or the unbinding of that which has been bound together historically, and the unraveling of the world is, I think, evident in all sorts of areas where one tends to look. So the logos, dissolving of the logos, I think, is evident, for example, in the way the technology we're talking about atomizes individuals, separates them one from the other, is hostile to socialization. There's nothing more hostile to sociability than social media. No? This epidemic of loneliness, this extreme, you know, isolation and loneliness that is engendered by the technology, now forces the victims of such loneliness to look to technology in order to alleviate the loneliness and to create relationships with their chat bots and so forth, no? So in that sense, you can't win. This is, as Heidegger understood, you know, in many ways, he understood that the era of technicity, the dominance of technicity, is one that has permeated every aspect of our existence, from the innermost regions of our psyche to the very institutional organization of our commonwealths. So,
I would say, based on what I have seen, what I have followed in terms of logos, I wouldn't say AI is there yet, because, I mean, if we think about what the output that these tools generate, they are mostly whatever humans have come up with, just reintegrate them, reproduce them in some way. So in terms of originality, I think we have seen incremental improvements, but it doesn't seem to be major breakthroughs so far. But of course, we don't know what the future might bring. And I think the point you mentioned about sociability is really important, because the extreme pessimist scenario would be that, why would I need to contact a professor if I can get an answer to my question instantly via the tool? Why would I need to go out and talk to my manager if I can get an help myself without talking to anyone?
Well, one reason would be because talking is a very natural activity among humans. And to talk is to act, if you believe Hannah Arendt, that the two forms of action are deeds as well as speech. And that when you talk, you never know where a conversation or a discourse will lead, because you are in dialogue with another human being. And this kind of co-thinking opens up possibilities for thoughts that you're not going to get when you're speaking to a tool. But even more importantly than that, I believe the way Socrates, for example, this idea, the Socratic idea that my talking with the other really begins with a conversation that I have with myself. This dialogue with myself is how he understood thinking. And that in order for me to have something to say, meaningful to say to my fellow human being, I really have to have this ongoing conversation in my own mind. And that's the realm of interiority where thinking is part of this dialogue with oneself. And so I'm attributing to Socrates, but as he says, if I'm going to murder someone, do I want to live the rest of my life with a murderer, namely myself, knowing that I'm a murderer or a thief or something? That, in other words, this relation one has to oneself, which is where thinking really takes place before it gets socialized, is also very important for the social aspects of the logos. And that's where I think the technology we've been referring to is assaulting the kind of silence within the mind of the individual where this kind of dialogue with oneself can take place. Because that is a place of psychic silence which originates thinking and genius and even scientific discoveries, things like that. When you fill it day in and day out, hour by hour, with noise, which is what a lot of is coming through the cell phone and the computers, a lot of it is noise, then you are actually drowning out the that possibility for thinking as a dialogue with oneself. And therefore, it's no surprise that young people today don't even know the basic fundamentals of social life. They don't know how to talk to one another in many cases, because they've lost the practice of even ordinary conversation. The ability to make small talk is beyond even the ken of many young people, because you've just taken away their world of interaction. They've done studies with language acquisition that they can, you can put children, small infants and children in front of a television for years, and they're hearing all this language coming out, and they cannot speak a word because it's purely passive. The only way you learn how to speak is by speaking. So that's what I worry, that AI can do all our thinking for us and answer every question that you have. But as a result, you're going to lose the ability to think for yourself. And, you know, anyone who's a teacher these days, especially at the university level, knows exactly what I'm talking about. And I say that increasingly more and more students, even a majority of them, when you ask them a question, the first thing they do, even in the classroom, is ask the question to AI. And they're completely dependent on the answers that they're getting from the tool. So is that something that we want to promote as our future? I don't think so.
Yeah, getting an instant answer to the questions that you have shouldn't be the point. Yeah, and being comfortable with the silence of uncertainty and then thinking through it. And if your thinking isn't enough, then going in dialogue with someone else has been the traditional way of creating knowledge, yeah, instead of instantly getting it instantly. That's not really the point. Yeah.
And that's what discursivity entails. Discursivity is a process of, you know, going from here to there to there. It's like combining this with that and the other. And it's because we are not gods. If you read Aristotle, the difference, God, nous, is perfectly self-coincident. And it doesn't need the discursive process to arrive at knowledge. All of that knowledge is contained within an atemporal, aspatial, self-coincident mind. But because we are mortal, and because we are finite, and because we are conditioned by our limitations, we need discourse and interaction, talking, creating consensus. And this becomes also the foundation. This is the basis of a republic or a democratic form of government, where we understand that no one is in full possession of the answer, and that it's in our deliberations one with another. It's through our exchange of ideas, especially in the public sphere, and presenting arguments. And the person who, those who can present the most persuasive arguments can persuade in the majority for a consensus, and that you come to a conclusion about policy, and then you promote a policy. And so republics depend on this kind of discursivity and the making sense within the context of no one having any claim to an absolute truth. We live within the relative, and the logos is this binding together of different points of view. What, again, I'm going to mention Hannah Arendt and the idea of plurality. We are a plurality when we live together in a world. And the form of government which allows the speech of the citizens to have equal rights in the public sphere is very important.
Yeah, in fundamental sense, yeah, the points you're making really make sense regarding the harmful effects of technology. Lately, I have been trying to find like more optimistic scenarios, maybe what can we make out of it. Like, for example, let's say if we treat AI just a tool, and let's think about this, yeah, like just by paying $20 per month, you can get a super intelligent tool for yourself and for everyone in the world. So I'm thinking maybe, why can't that be the more optimistic future? Maybe we need some adjustment periods before that to adapt and see how that will play out. But fundamentally, I see your point that it is uncertain future, and we don't know what it will do to biology, culture, which everything is based on everything is built upon?
Well, you use the word tool, and there, when one wants to be optimistic, and I would like to be optimistic too, it's natural to assume that AI and other forms of technology that we're talking about are tools, and that we use them for our own purposes. I think we've lost our innocence on that score and understand that technology is not a tool, but it is a destiny. It's a world destiny. It's something which has enframed our whole way of being in the world, and that we are within the very dictates of technology, and that technology has a will of its own, and that it's connected to the will to power that is so fundamentally human. But at the same time, technology is always promoting more and more of itself. It cannot help but promote more and more of itself. And for us to believe that technology is a tool that we can use for our own kind of enhancement, I think is blinding oneself to the fact that we have become the very tools of technology. And we are the enablers, that the technology is using us in order to promote its own optimizations and self-enhancements. And it's leading to an ever more technocratic society, and also eventually a technocratic government. And this is where, I hate to say it, but China is the terrifying nightmare of what awaits us in a completely technologized world where AI is aggressively in control of every aspect of existence. And it's very easy when you look at where a country like China is going to see that humanity is actually a very fragile thing. You can put an end to humanity, as we've been talking about it, by a kind of willful imposition of technology and artificial intelligence, and the utter complete control of the inner life and outer life of citizens by the technical. So I don't believe technology is a tool. And I think the tech bros and all even technology is using their own kind of wild ambitions and desires for creating an afterlife for themselves, or, you know, leaving something behind, and or to become great heroes, that all that is enlisted as the tools of the very inhuman destiny of technology itself. We are its handmaidens, I believe.
Another interesting related idea, if we talk about the memories, human memories. So, I mean, if I try to think about my grandfather's grandfather's grandfather, I may have some idea about what he might have looked like. I may have heard some stories, what happened. But that's all, It lives in stories that pass throughout the generations. But if I think about my own, let's say, if I have a child in the future, let's say, my own granddaughters, grandsons, granddaughters, they will be able to see me. They will be able to watch this podcast in the future. They will see, they will understand what I look like. They don't have to rely on memories. They don't have to rely on stories. And I mean, maybe you would find this, the second point, more pessimistic, is that there might be an AI model built based on what I have said in my lifetime, and there might be future avatar Masoud AI that they can talk to, and in their mind, I've never died. Okay, I'm always alive. They can always talk to me, even if physically I'm dead.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That's right, and it's bound to happen. It's almost bound to happen, and there are some momentous revolutions, mostly in the 20th century, 19th century as well. Photographs took the place of the painted portrait, where you had at least the image of the ancestor in the house. That painted portrait, its genealogy goes back to the death masks that would sometimes be taken right off the deceased person. So you go from a death mask, you know, the statue, to the painted portrait, to the photograph. Now you can see the photograph, and then you have, you know, the movie, the videos, and the home video, so you can see. Yeah. And you're right. Now the voice technologies, radio, and we can hear. What's so uncanny is that we are immersed in a world with the voices of the dead and the images of the dead. We hear John F. Kennedy's words or Martin Luther King, or we see them on television. And our ancestors, as you say, in a couple of generations, we're all going to be avatars. And you can. The problem is, again, we go back to the intractable limits of the human condition. And there's only so much that one human being can take in. And if you're going to drown, if you're going to overpopulate the world with all these, the detritus of the past, and every podcast, everything is being recorded. Everything has an online perpetual existence now. And you're adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. You know, I have a podcast of my own entitled Opinions, which I started 20 years ago. And there were hardly any intellectual podcasts. There were two or three or four. And at that point, there wasn't even a word for podcast. And then now, 20 years later, every third person has a podcast that and these things don't disappear, as you say. So this increasing inundation of the world with the noise of our everyday kind of discourse, it's going to be a problem. So it would be great for your great-great-grandchildren to see you and have an avatar of you and be able to communicate with you. But they're going to have so many options. They're going to have to be so over chock full of such possibilities that it's just going to add to the noise, I think.
Yeah, I think.
Plus, I think there's a difference between a living memory and a kind of a digital memory. That when you, what you know about your great grandfather, things you learn through an oral tradition of transmission. And something is preserved, the life of the past is preserved when someone has a living memory of it. And I can repeat stories that my mother told me about some of our ancestors, but when she died, it was a living memory that connected you to the world that belonged to that also died. So I believe that there's certain charisma in the way these memories used to be communicated from generation to generation. That is different from a digital preservation that you mentioned.
I think it also relates to what you mentioned earlier, with the socialization with the other people, where you share ideas. Right. But if I have it digital available all the time, I don't need to go and ask my mother, father, what Masoud looked like, Rob looked like. I can just open the YouTube and go to the video and watch it. So. Why do I have to talk to my mother? Yeah. I mean, that's a pessimistic scenario. Yeah, there are many reasons why you should talk to people. Yeah.
Well, also because there's this strange psychological thing that occurs when someone dies, a loved one dies in the family, that there's this idealization that, you know, death makes angels of us all. So what is transmitted in terms of the living memory is a highly idealized portrait of the great grandfather or something highly idealized, slightly idealized, whatever. And the dead should have the glow or the aura of the heroic in a certain way, or the legendary, or the mythical. And that's what might get lost when the living memory through discourse gives way to a digital replication of the person himself or herself. No?
Yeah, that's when we talk about these ideas, it's kind of crazy what will happen in the future. It's at one point, it's also exciting because we don't know what there might be also positive developments. I try to be also optimistic in some scenario, but there are, I mean, I also hear you fundamentally that these are the fundamental questions that humanity has to wrestle with. What kind of future do you want? What is valuable to preserve? What is good about humanity that we have had so far that we want to preserve?
What we want to preserve. What is the essential and what is the inessential? You want to preserve the essential. And that means that we have to know, have some idea of what the essential is. And it might involve a choice of what is essential. So we want to preserve, and then we also want to be, we must be willing also to dispose of the inessential. So as long as we keep this kind of debate open and keep thinking, then I think there's a possibility that we can arrive at a point where we can distinguish between the essential and the inessential. What worries me is the foreclosure of the thought process, where the inessential now takes the place of the essential, and we lose the baby in the bathwater, and that we hold on to what we might have done better to dispose of, rather, and to preserve, to again preserving what is essential.
Yeah, getting an instant answer to your question might be inessential compared to thinking, yeah, outsourcing your thinking, like preserving your thinking as opposed to outsourcing your thinking.
Yes, you know, when you can't get an answer to a question, that's when you start thinking for yourself, right? And I think it would be ingenious if AI could incorporate the humility of a Socratic wisdom, I do not know. If you ask a question and it says, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. For the moment, it is adopting the posture of being able to answer any question you put to it, no? As if it, you know, it's the bravado of the new technology. But if it could ever internalize the humility of philosophy, which is to say that knowledge begins in a state of ignorance, and it's I do not know the answer to this, and therefore I am in wonder. Wonder also is an attitude, a disposition of being, on the one hand, marveling at something that you cannot explain, and that is enigmatic. So not knowing is something that we want to preserve. I think it's important to preserve an awareness of how generative can be the condition of unknowing, or not of unknowing, but of not knowing.
I think those two quotes, first by Socrates, where he says, I know one thing that I do not know anything. And then the next one by Aristoteles, when he says, everyone by their nature wants to know. Yes. Yeah, those two quotes might be the fundamental. I mean, they are so beautiful in terms of explaining what goes on inside the mind.
I agree. And then there's a third thing I would add, and I'll just say that in the next issue of the New York Review of Books, I don't know when our show will air, but it's going to be in a week or two. I reviewed two books about this question of knowing. And one is by Mark Lillis called Ignorance and Bliss, which is a book about how there's a will not to know in our present day society, in a lot of people, where it's easier just to willfully ignore or remain ignorant than assume the responsibility of knowing. So Aristotle's dictum that all human beings desire to know has to be supplemented with the idea that there is also, at least certainly in the modern psyche, that there is also a will not to know that's very active in our day and age.
Yeah, that's interesting. I would like to check it out once it's out. Yeah, but that's. Another question, since I also asked about what philosophers, writers, authors, poets have influenced your intellectual development or your worldview, in a sense, if you can name a few names here.
Well, there are some of the usual suspects. Nietzsche was very important when I was young. For like a lot of people, he has a powerful appeal to at a certain age. I don't think that one grows out of Nietzsche. One understands that there is a lot more in later stages of life. One understands there's a lot more to Nietzsche than what you thought was the case when you were young. Heidegger was important for me in the mid period. You know, there was something about his this sort of religion of thinking, if I can call it that, I think our conversation shows that the legacies of that religion of thinking is still something that has stayed with me. Giambattista Vico, the 18th century Italian thinker, the author of The New Science, is someone I've taught a lot and who has been perhaps the most important influence in at least my written work, for sure. And one thing about Vico that was for me important after I went through a Heideggerian phase was the idea that the abstractions of philosophy have to somehow find a proper marriage with the certainty of what he called philology. So a philosophical anthropology is something that Vico offered me a model for, which was important because I get frustrated sometimes with the standard philosophical remaining in the realm of abstraction without connecting the abstraction to the world of phenomena. And so giving certainty to truth, that's Vico's terms. And that's where, for me, the poets have been perhaps the greatest inspiration more than philosophers. Because I believe that a lot of poetry knows more intuitively and profoundly what philosophy is seeking to understand and presents it in a language which itself, rather than providing explanation, provides revelation. So I'm big on looking for revelation as opposed to explanation. I think explanations foreclose the enigma and the mystery of things, whereas revelation keeps open the penumbra of opacity that surrounds whatever we know, either through our senses or perception or cognition. And therefore, for me, poetry is where I go for the most important insights into the nature of reality. I could name, 100 poets that do the work of poetry as I understand it. But I quoted Wallace Stevens, let him be the stand-in for all the others as well.
Yeah, poetry is beautiful. No, in the modern sense, depending on who you talk to, my overall understanding is that poetry is underappreciated these days in the domain of intellectual discussions and conversations. It's everything is treated as if something that needs to be solved quickly and moved on to another philosophical question. Yeah, let's define consciousness and move on to the next. Let's define that, move on to the next. But there is, I feel that it's really undervalued, poetry, in that sense.
Right. It doesn't explain and then move on, because that's the difference between revelation and explanation. Revelation keeps open and invites further probing and to go more in depth into the same phenomenon. You know, poetry presents you with the inexhaustible. And we tend to undervalue the inexhaustible, but it's where the real is hiding most prominently, I believe.
And I agree with the Nietzsche point. I mean, in my own personal life, I've observed this as well. Nietzsche's philosophy, especially the self-transformation and what he talks about this in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, is really valuable if you feel down, maybe without motivation, what you want to do, or maybe if you are shy as a person, you don't know how to speak up. I really feel that there is really value there following Nietzsche's philosophy to a point in terms of that, yeah, personal development.
Are you referring to the three metamorphoses? Thus spoke Zarathustra, where you begin as a camel and then a lion and a child, yeah. You end up as a child.
I've tried to understand that. To be honest, that part is a bit abstract. I didn't really understand what Nietzsche means. I know it's about self transformation, moving to the stages. But the point about Nietzsche is that if every time you read it, it's like a different insight. And he makes it even difficult for you to understand because he deliberately keeps them hidden, as you mentioned with the poetry. Yeah? There is always something hidden there with the Nietzsche.
Yes, for sure. And that's why you keep going back to him because, as you say, there's always something new that comes out. He's not trying to terminate the process of questioning. He's trying to keep open the process of questioning.
Yeah. Great. We talked a lot about technological developments. We touched upon some pessimistic scenarios. Okay, let me ask you this. What are you most hopeful about the future? Anything you can mention?
Well, what makes me most hopeful is the fact that within the human condition is this capacity for natality or new initiatives. And what that means is that you never know from where some kind of newness is going to arise. And that as long as there are young people coming into the world, there is this possibility of natalities that one can't foresee or predict. But that I'm hopeful that we have been around for way too long to allow this story of humanity to just plunge into a black hole and stay there. I'm hopeful that in one way or another, there's going to be a new revelation of a different way of being in the world that will perhaps take inspiration from something that Thoreau says in Walden when he says, simplify, simplify, simplify. Let your affairs be as two or three rather than 100 or 1,000. And the extraordinary complexity of the society we live in and the lives that we are entangled in, this extraordinary complexity is too much for the human to bear, any human to bear. And I'm hopeful that we will find a way to indeed simplify, 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 which again will entail understanding what to preserve and what not to preserve. And that in turn will entail knowing how to distinguish between the essential and the inessential.
Robert, it's been great. You are great. I really enjoyed this discussion. Just a final one. What are you working on these days? Are you writing any new book? You mentioned the podcast. Like, where should people go to check out your work if they're interested?
Well, the podcast is called Entitled Opinions, and it's on all the major platforms. I mean, Apple, Spotify. Spotify takes down a number of our shows because I play music, and I refuse to, keep it under 10 seconds or whatever they demand. So, but Apple Podcasts, there's a website. It's people interested in philosophy. It is heavily oriented towards philosophy, but also to literature, especially literature, science as well. And the book that I'm writing, hoping to finish soon, is called The Spirit of Gravity, Chronicles of a Mortal Earth. And I'm not going to go into it now, all of the arcana of the book, but it does have a lot to do with what we were speaking about in this last hour and a half about the earth as a place of finitude, mortality, limit, and the need to re-inhabit the earth in a different way, and to rediscover the ground that we are walking on, almost in a literal sense, namely the earth as a particular place of habitation. So I'm hoping it will bring a new kind of thinking that is not just a reiteration of what I've done before in my previous books.
Very nice. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, Robert.
Thank you, Masood. You take care.